Ellie, you may begin now. The program is being recorded now. It has started being. So the recording has started. You may begin, Ellie.
Assalamu alaikum. Sorry, I think he was muted that time.
Oh, it's okay. Walaikum salam.
This is Surah Adiyat. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wal adiyati zabaha. فَالْمُودِيَاتِ كَدْحًا فَالْمُغِيرَاتِ صُبْحًا فَآثَرْنَا بِهِ نَكَأً فَوَسَطْنَا بِهِ جَمْعًا إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لِرَبِّهِ لَكَنُودٌ وَإِنَّهُ عَلَى ذَلِكَ لَشَهِيدٌ وَإِنَّهُ لِحُبِّ الْخَيْرِ لَشَدِيدٌ أَفَلَا يَعْلَمُ إِذَا بُعْثِرَ مَا فِي الْقُبُورِ وَحُصِّلَ مَا فِي الصُّدُورِ Inna rabbahum bihim yawma izil lakhabir. Sadaqallahu al-aliyyul azim. Allahumma assal ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma assal ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Thank you, Ali, for your beautiful recitation of the surah. A constant reminder that we begin our sessions, our lectures, with the recitation of the Holy Quran, that along with the Ahlul Bayt, that we must maintain and strengthen our bond with the Holy Quran as well, because according to the Hadith of Thaqalain, that is what our Prophet has left us with, you know, is Ahlul Bayt and the Quran. You cannot have one without the other, and hopefully we can develop a stronger relationship with it. Without further ado, now I would like to invite Brother Ali Mujtaba to come forward and recite the salam for us, please.
As-salam.
Alaykum as-salam.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. On the day of Ashura, grandson of Rasulullah, lost his loved ones and was slaughtered. What a cruelty, Allah. On the night of Ashura, Imam said, O Ya Khuda, I am fulfilling my promise. Here's my life, Jazakallah. All of them offered salat, obeying God's ahkamat, getting ready for the morning, the last morning in the world. Ali Akbar gave azan, raising the voice of Iman, and the flag was raised by Abbas, marking morning of the war. Fi Aman Allah was done to the daughters and the sons. Everybody then got ready to be martyred in the war. First Ashab went to the fight, poor Habib who showed the might. Imam kept them in his sight, thinking of the coming night, when his family will be left with the cruel enemies. How are Bibi, Zainab, and Sajjad, they're going to pass the night? After all the friends were gone, Imam was left all alone. It was the turn of his own kids on Muhammad came along. Oh, our uncle and Imam, take the test of our Iman. We will show them that Ali has lions for his grandsons. Zainab sacrificed her sons, son of Hassan next in turn. He was trained by Uncle Abbas. Fighting skills were number one. His shahadat was a wound that Imam had really owned. Death of Qasim was the death of Hassan happening once more. Abbas was the general, he was dearest brother. When he went to battlefield, then Imam's heart went with him there. Limbs of Abbas when were lost, hopes of Hussein were the cause. Trembled skies and trembled grounds, oh, Euphrates was in the tears. Then departed Akbar, who looked like Peygamber. When he fought the enemies, thought Ali was fighting the war. Eventually he went down, head of spear brought him to ground. Wallah, wallah, Imam Hussein, this was the most toughest one. Now Imam was all alone, nobody was there to mourn. Death of Abbas, death of Akbar, came from cradle, little one. Oh, Baba, I am here. Don't you see I have no fear? I will go and fight the battle and achieve the martyrdom. Then Hussein ibn Ali, son of Fatima and Ali, realized it was the moment appointed Imam to be. Imam Zainul Abidin, after Asr will be seen, as Imam Waqt-e who is full of tears and full of grief. On the day of Ashura, grandson of Rasulullah, lost his loved ones and was slaughtered. What a cruelty, Ya Allah. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Thank you so much, Ali Mujtaba, for your beautiful recitation of the salam, and I apologize for the slight delay. Again, I would like to urge everyone to send their questions on to Babul Ilm Society, any questions that may arise, any questions that already exist. Please feel free to ask, and the Sheikh will now be continuing his lecture on the topic of the special companions of the Imams. So, Sheikhuna, you may begin if you are here with us now.
Assalamu alaikum, yes, inshallah. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah. Rabbil alameen. Bari'il khalaiqi ajma'in. Ba'ithil anbiya wal mursaleen. Wa salatu wa salam ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina. Wa habibina. Habibi qulubina wa tabibi nufusina. Wa shafi'i dhunubina. Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening the return of our Imam, let's recite the salawat. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Inshallah, today we will continue discussing Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, to inshallah cover and explore more the aspect of the greatness of this companion that I think is important for us today. We introduced him yesterday and how he was a general of the Imam in the type of warfare that Imam Zainul Abidin was involved in. Each of the Imams was at war with the tyrants of the time. But the warfare and the context of the war was different. The Imams were never complacent. They were never absent from the battlefield of fighting dhulm and oppression. They were constantly involved in that. Every single one of our Imams. The thing is that the conditions dictated a certain type of warfare at each of those different times. And the army of Imam Zainul Abidin were people like Abu Khalid al-Kabuli that were able to increase the number of the Muslimin who were more familiar with the true teachings of Islam and were willing to follow the path of the Imams leading against the oppression and the atrocities of the tyrants towards the justice and the teachings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The aspect of Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, the quality, the characteristic that I would like to discuss and for us to learn from has to do with a hadith that he narrates for us from Imam Zain al-Abidin. The hadith has to do with the people who are awaiting the coming of our Imam. In the hadith, Imam Zain al-Abidin to Abu Khalid al-Kabuli gives some of the descriptions of the time of the occultation of the Imam, who is now our Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif. But at the time, it wasn't mentioned exactly in that way. It's discussing the occultation of an Imam in the times to come. That's one description we find there. And the other description is the description of those who are awaiting him. In the hadith regarding those who are awaiting the Imam during that occultation, there's a certain quality mentioned that we see Abu Khalid himself having it during his time. And I want to draw some parallels between this description that the Imam through Abu Khalid tells us, the wording of it, and again through Abu Khalid and his conduct, his behavior, his part in the movement of the Imam, he has shown that to us in action as a companion of the Imam. The quality which is mentioned there is the quality of knowing the conditions, the surroundings, and knowing the Imam, knowing the occultation, knowing their role, knowing what they need to do, knowledge of the path. This is something that is found in the hadith. In other words, while they are in the state of occultation, which means that the Imam is absent from them, they cannot communicate with the Imam. They're not able to get in touch with him in a way where they hear his response. We can always get in touch with the Imam of our time. We can always speak to him. We can always talk to him. We can always communicate. We can always feel his presence. But we are deprived from hearing his voice and seeing him in a way where we can identify him and know that it's him. We are deprived of that for the most part. There are some individuals in the past and perhaps even today that, according to the hadith of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh, do have access to the Imam and they do see the Imam. But those are not the majority of people, even the majority of good people, the great companions of the Imam. They don't get to see the 12th Imam in the way we see each other. We see normal people that are around and we identify them. We know who they are, our friends or ulama or whatever. In this way, we're not able to communicate, to see, and to recognize our Imam, even for the good believers. The majority aren't allowed to have that. There's a reason for it. Only a few are allowed and they have that connection with the Imam. They are, of course, above all. But that doesn't mean that if a person is a good believer, that he should expect to be able to see the Imam. One has got to be taken by the Imam to be one of those very special companions at a time that he is supposed to be in hiding for him to share his identity with that person. But according to the hadith of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayh, clearly there are some. That's an important thing to note. Coming back to Abu Khalid and what he says, quoting Imam Zain al-Abidin and then what he does, that while the majority don't have good believers, the ones who are really awaiting the 12th Imam, they don't have access to the Imam. They don't see or hear him. However, they know his path. They know his direction. They know what that means for them. They know what that translates to into in their actions, and they implement it. This is a description that we have. Abu Khalid himself implemented this. He, in a sense, was in a state of occultation as well. In a different way, of course, an occultation that was chosen. He chose it based on a responsibility that was given to him, of course. He chose to follow that and obey that command, and that caused a form of occultation. Abu Khalid al-Kabuli had to leave Imam Zain al-Abidin and go over there to his hometown, somewhere near Kabul, and establish the base of the Imam there. And from that point onwards to the end of his life, without seeing Imam Zain al-Abidin, to continue with the path of the Imam, awaiting the outcome, which is the establishment of the government of Islam. And he doesn't know when that's going to happen. He doesn't know when the Imam or which Imam is exactly going to make that move against the Umayyads at that time. But he knew that was something that the Imams had planned. He was their student, their very close student. This resembles occultation. In what way? In the way that he didn't have access to Imam Zain al-Abidin after leaving Medina. He didn't have access to him. He didn't see him anymore. He didn't send messengers. It wasn't supposed to be such that Abu Khalid communicates with the Imam after that. He was supposed to be on his own over there, as though the Imam is not there. This is what we see from his conduct, his behavior after leaving. There's no trace of him. The only trace is the outcome, the result. We explained that yesterday. I don't want to be redundant. Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, in his region, after his physical disconnect with the Imam, He left and he's not going back. He's not communicating. He's not supposed to. That's the command. He is doing his obligation in that state, knowing what the goal is, knowing what the objective is, the direction of the imam, that now he's a general that's supposed to be functioning independently. Understanding all of that, the goal, the direction, understanding the conditions in his area, his region, his domain, the area that he needs to be involved in, the area he needs to work on, the area he has been given the responsibility of. He understands the terrain. He understands the conditions. He understands the waters that he's treading. And the combination of those leads to a full understanding, a complete understanding of what he specifically in that context needs to do. And then comes practice. And comes implementation, and comes the idea of actually doing that and then being successful. He succeeded. He succeeded getting the masses in that area, in that region, over the course of a couple of decades to transform from people who were oblivious to the existence of the notion of the Ahlul Bayt, the belief in the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet equating to the Quran. People who were completely oblivious to that and what they had heard of the Ahlul Bayt that we refer to as Ahlul Bayt, they referred to them by their names and they had heard things that were negative about them. They transformed from these types of people to people that understood that they need to refer to the Ahlul Bayt in important matters, in fact, the most important matter, which is governance. And for that, they need to sacrifice their lives. They need to come to the battle. They need to be willing to come to the battlefield for that. Over the course of a few decades, with the work of Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, this happened. How did he do that? We don't have the details. But what we do understand is this. He knew, he had a complete and full understanding of what his task over there is. Number one, based on the goals that he had learned from Imam Zain al-Abidin, the direction that he needs to have. Over the course of years, not just go do this one thing. The Imam did not command him, go do this one thing. For instance, talk to this person or talk to that person or teach this point or teach that point. The idea is the people of that region need to come to the Ahlul Bayt. How do you do that? Abu Khalid, it's your job. You go figure out how it's done. You have to go over there, establish your roots, or reestablish your roots, connect to your roots. Understand the context, understand the conditions, understand the people, understand what they're hearing, where their headspace is, how can that be transformed? You need to understand it and change that to what it needs to be. Abu Khalid, may Allah bless his soul. He was very successful. He did what he had to do. To find a companion which is that successful in bringing so many people to the Ahlul Bayt is very difficult, very difficult. We have a hadith. There were certain companions that were good companions. They loved the Ahlul Bayt. In fact, they loved the Ahlul Bayt so much and they hated their enemies so much that they would get into heated debates. Heated debates. With those who just didn't believe in the imams. Not those who hated on the imam. Not those who said wrong things. Those who just simply didn't believe. I won't name him. I have his name in mind. There's a particular companion. Two that just came to my mind, actually. Initially one, then the other. they used to get into heated discussions, heated debates about the Ahlul Bayt. Why? Because they love the Ahlul Bayt. They love them to death. And they hated those who had caused them not to be in the position they're supposed to be in. What did that cause? They went and debated average people. Anyone who just didn't believe. Some of the average ulama or scholars of those outside the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt who didn't believe in the Ahlul Bayt. They weren't against the Ahlul Bayt. They weren't fighting the Ahlul Bayt. They were just not on board. We'd go and debate and then get into heated discussions. The imams told them, look, please, in one particular case, the imam tells the person, look, you do not debate anyone on this matter. Why? Because he knows once he gets involved into a debate, it gets heated. A heated debate about the Ahlul Bayt, a heated debate about the truth of Islam, a heated debate about the truth of anything with people who are simply unaware of the facts, unaware of what you're saying, affected and influenced by the propaganda of a system in place, debating with such a person, with such people, will only have the effect of turning them away. That's one of the things we're dealing with, brothers and sisters, and it's very relevant to the topic, to the task at hand that we understand from this hadith, and we see Abu Khalid himself implementing, and we need to learn from that. One of the things that's happening these days is that there's this urge, this want, this desire amongst the followers of the Ahlul Bayt to debate those who don't believe in him amongst the Muslimin. Sometimes those who are simply unaware, sometimes debating those who are aware but are against on satellite channels and otherwise and so on and so forth. These types of efforts, the thought process, the mindset of the person, the Shia, the follower of the Ahlul Bayt, getting involved in this debate. I want to defend the Ahlul Bayt. I want to bring people to the Ahlul Bayt. I want to defend the Ahlul Bayt, these enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. Is that what we're supposed to do? Are we bringing Shias to the Imam? Are we bringing people to the Imam? Are we having masses join? Is that what we're having? These satellite channels that have been created by those claiming to defend the Ahlul Bayt, have they brought masses in from the regions that are under the influence of those satellite channels? Or are they causing division? Are they causing fights? Are they causing arguments? The Ahlul Bayt don't want arguments between Muslimin. The Ahlul Bayt lived amongst the Muslimin. They had their companions live amongst the Muslimin, not separate from the masses of the Muslimin, have good ties with the masses of the Muslimin, and then allow them to see the truth of the Ahlul Bayt by that pleasant encounter and just seeing what a believer in the Ahlul Bayt lives like and speaks of. If the follower of the Ahlul Bayt, the lover of the Ahlul Bayt, every time he sees someone who does not believe in, turns an angry, ugly face towards them, speaks against them, or they hear that in their absence he speaks against them, he calls them munafiq, he calls them kafir, he calls them this, he calls them that. Are they going to come to the Ahlul Bayt? Are they going to come to the Imam? How do you think all those numbers that Abu Khalid brought to the Imam came to the Imam? Do you think he went to their doors and said, la'anatullah ala this, la'anatullah ala that? Mentioning the names of the Ahlul Bayt, never mentioned in their curses? You think that's how Abu Khalid brought these people? Or he represented the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt with implementing the teachings in terms of his worship of Allah, and some of that is visible to the people. The people see this is a man of the Quran. He knows Quran more than we do. He's a man that knows the Prophet the sunnah of the Prophet, the sayings of the Prophet, the battles of the Prophet, the treaties of the Prophet, every step of the Prophet's life, this man knows more than we do. They see that this man, when he walks, what they've heard of the Prophet, which is the akhlaq of giving salam to even the children that are usually seen as nobodies and they don't deserve respect. And so elder people do not give salam. They see Abu Khalid is someone who gives salam to these children. He respects them. He respects people. He speaks with wisdom. His conversation, his talk is not in vain. He doesn't say things that are useless. He does not say ugly things. His tongue is not covered with filth of mentioning dirty and filthy words, even against the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. You see, this man is someone that has akhlaq. They see these things. And then when a man with this demeanor tells them, the Prophet said, أَنَا مَدِينَةُ الْعِلْمِ وَعَلِيٌ بَابُهَا. People say, oh, Ali was the gate of the knowledge of the Prophet. He says, yes, that's what the Prophet said. Not going shouting, Aliyun, ana madinatul ilm wa aliyun babuha. You have to listen to Ali ibn Abi Talib. He establishes his roots. He slowly allows this character to be seen by people, just doing his normal thing. He's just silent about his mission at the time initially, gradually allowing for his connections with the people that some of whom he previously knew, probably in his area. Some of those who are now getting to know him, they know he went to Medina, the city of the Prophet, gained knowledge and has now come back. Allow them to absorb this person, observe him while he's just doing his taklif. He's not trying to show anything off. He's not trying to do this for the people. His taklif is he realizes that if I want to spread the message of Imam Zain al-Abidin amongst these people who don't know who he is, who don't know who his father was, who don't know, they heard something about Husayn ibn Ali being slaughtered, but they didn't really get what happened, why it happened all the way out here. They heard some good things about Ali ibn Abi Talib, the description of the qualities of Ali ibn Abi Talib were there, but that's some of the elders, because when the Umayyads came in, they made sure everybody hears the opposite of that about Ali ibn Abi Talib, about Imam al-Mujtaba. They don't know, or they know wrong misinformation. They have misinformation. He realizes, if I want to share this knowledge, they don't know me either. I just need to live there and be with these people. Over time, once we develop a relationship, then gradually I will start talking to them. And how do you do that? By just being a good Shia. Which means I follow the instructions of Islam. Then when this character is seen, now I can start talking. Brother, sister, did you know about Ali? Did you know about Fatima? Let me tell you about Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha. This is who she is. Not going straight to the issue. After the Prophet, they killed his daughter. Well, they don't even know who his daughter is. The majority of Muslimin today, this, don't just take this from me, go look at the clips yourself. A Sunni alim, a legitimate Sunni alim, a good Sunni alim, and there are many who is in search of the truth. He says, Adnan Ibrahim, you can find him, he lives in Europe. The clips I saw a few years ago, there may be other clips that are there. He's not Shia, and he thinks that we are deviant. And I consider that a misunderstanding of his. I don't consider him to be an enemy that's wrong. I think that's his understanding, but obviously we disagree. Like, no, I think you need to look more into it. But he says, why were the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt kept away from us? Why don't we see the fada'il of the Ahlul Bayt? The majority of people, this is kept away from them. They don't know. Even today, after all the greatness of the Ahlul Bayt that has come to them, they don't know. And we go to this difference or unfortunately, in some areas, we've created such a scene that the whole thing about the Ahlul Bayt is a fight. This guy says they're great. The other guy says, why do you talk about them all the time? Let's move away from that. Anyhow, he allows that to happen once that character, that demeanor is established. He starts talking to people over time. He's able to accomplish that. He understands the context. He understands the conditions. And he acts based on wisdom. And he's able to do all of that. The other companions, they only threw people away. The Imam said, no, I don't want you to debate. Please don't debate. Let Hisham ibn Hakam debate. He knows how to debate. He knows the rules of debate. He knows the respect in a debate. He doesn't get heated in a debate. He provides wisdom and reason and understanding in his discussions without getting heated, without getting all worked up, without getting all emotional. Presents what needs to be presented in a way where it's understandable. Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, of course, compared to Hisham ibn Hakam and all these people, what he did was on a completely different level, much, much higher level in terms of the numbers he brought that were willing to do that. This is very important for us, brothers and sisters. Let me remind us of the idea we're presenting, what Abu Khalid did, what the hadith was again. And again, a reminder of that. And then we will try to see how this is very relevant to us. The hadith was that the ones who are muntadhir, who are awaiting the imam in occultation, one of their qualities is that they have ma'rifah. They have understanding of the imam, of his direction, of the goals, the objectives he's trying to acquire and accomplish. And they move in that direction during the occultation. Which means without seeing the imam, they understand all of that. And then they implement it. And we said Abu Khalid al-Kabuli did that in the absence of the imam. That happened for him based on his choice, because of a command of Imam Zain al-Abidin to go to those areas, to his own hometown. But then when he gets there, disconnect. That's the state of occultation. But then understanding the conditions, understanding the goals and objectives, understanding what the Imam wants from him specifically there, doing it, he was able to accomplish that. We, brothers and sisters, according to the hadith of Imam Zain al-Abidin that Abu Khalid tells us, and he himself implemented that on his level, at his time, with the type of occultation he was in, we've got to do the same. When we talk about awaiting the coming of the Imam of our time, it's all a great discussion, reminders of the Imam coming, how great it will be when he comes, and so on and so forth, and how much love we have for him. Every conversation about him, about his coming, about us preparing, gets us excited. We like to hear about it. We like to be involved in that discussion. But then what's the practical outcome of that? Everybody asks, how do we prepare? The short answer for how do we prepare is this. Everybody go work on it. How you prepare is this. Your ma'rifah of the imam, of his goals, of his direction, of what he's trying to accomplish, and your understanding of the conditions you're in have got to be so clear for you that during the time of the occultation, you are going to be following the path of the Imam of our time, doing what you need to do, what the Imam wants you to do, specifically in your conditions. You have to understand that, figure it out, and implement it. What does that mean, Shaykh, for me? It means you need to go figure it out. Don't ask me. If you ask me what are the goals of the Imam, I say, okay, I can talk to you about what the goals of the Imam are. And I'll tell you, because this is not right now the topic of our conversation, but I'll give you some reference. Go read Dua Nudbah. All those lines, you say, where is Ayna Baqiyatullah, starting with that line. Where is the remainder of God? Baqiyatullah roughly translates to that, Baqiyatullah. Or what God has kept and has allowed to remain, Baqiyatullah. Ayna Baqiyatullah, where is he? From that point onwards, read the lines of Dua Nudbah with translation. Look at it. And what it says, all of those lines that are there are going to be telling you the goals and objectives of the Imam of our time. If you ask me those things, I say, I can talk to you about that, what the goals of the Imam are, what the goals of the Ahlul Bayt were, what the goals of the Quran for mankind are. We can talk about those. Ask me, what are some of the methods that Islam says you shouldn't use? Some of the methods general that you should use. Okay, here are some ideas. These are things that Islam says, do these things. The other thing is, don't do those things. These are some ideas. But don't ask me, what do I do? Well, that's what you need to figure out. That's what you need to figure out. Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, based on the command of the Imam, went over there and he had to disconnect. He can't call the Imam and say, I'm in this condition. What am I supposed to do? He says, I already taught you the guidelines of Islam. How that applies in your condition is up to you to decide. You need to understand it, not just make any decision. You need to make an accurate decision based on an accurate understanding of the conditions you're in. That's your job. Don't ask me. 13 ma'soom have left behind an abundance of statements, more than what we need until the coming of the Imam, with all of that valuable information. They've left all of that. The Prophet left behind the Quran and the 12 ma'sums before the 12th Imam. We have 14 ma'sumin. Other than the Prophet and the 12th Imam, there's 12, including Fatimatul Zahra, and 11 Imams. The Prophet says, I left the Quran along with the Ahlul Bayt. The Quran is available to us. The words of 13 ma'sum are available to us. We have them. Imam says, these are the guidelines. I said, Imam, can you tell me, do I do this, do I not? I gave you the guidelines. You're supposed to verify what the conditions are. When does this hadith apply? When does the other hadith apply? When does this teaching apply? Where does that teaching apply? Where does the patience come in when the enemies attack you? When do you attack back? Both are in the Quran. The Quran talks about patience. They're attacking you, they're torturing you, they're killing you. The Quran says, be patient, be patient. Now is not the time. That's in the Quran. Then the other verse, أُذِنَ لِلَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا, and so on and so forth. The إذن, the permission, now go and fight. And then from that point onwards, if you don't go and fight, you're going to be in hellfire, in different wordings. When does this apply? When does that apply? You need to go understand. Figure out the conditions. We have a long way ahead of us. For those who want to be like this, want to learn from Abu Khalid, to be one of those special companions. Brothers, sisters, you have the opportunity. You're in your early ages. And what's ahead of you is to bring, like Abu Khalid did, thousands upon thousands of people to like and want Imam Al-Hujjah Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, to the degree that they're willing to sacrifice for Imam Al-Hujjah. That's what the people in that region did through the teachings of Abu Khalid. Imagine taking a whole army of people that with their words, with their arts, with their writings, with their presence on the street when necessary, are supporting the Imam of our time. It's possible. We have to do what Abu Khalid did. Abu Khalid learned from the Imam. We don't have access to the Imam, but as I said, we have access to the words of the Imams. We have access to the Quran. Read and read and read and read. Study. Do whatever you can to learn this to the best of your ability. And different people have different abilities. I don't need to worry about, oh, I'm not like this. I don't have this. I don't have that. It doesn't matter what you don't have. You do have certain things. Do what you, based on what you have, what's available to you. Learn. Think. Contemplate. Learn the conditions that you're in. When you're reading Islamic literature, with the understanding, a correct understanding of the conditions you're in, when you're reading that literature, try to see, is that literature talking about a condition you're in or is it not? Think about it. And then gradually you'll start to see, oh, this applies to my condition. That doesn't apply. That's for another condition. All of Islam applies wherever the conditions are. The teachings are dynamic in a way where in every condition there's a solution, but each solution is for that condition, not for the other. When you start reading, you're like, oh, this applies, this is for this condition. The other is not for this, it's for another condition. You start realizing and you start applying. He learned from Imam Zain al-Abidin Islam. That's one thing he did. We need that. We need to learn it. And it's up to us. He traveled to go and learn it. He spent years outside of his hometown. People speaking a completely different language. He did all of that for Islam. The result of that is what he did. And the other thing is, understand your context. Understand where you are. Understand what they're doing. Understand what the enemies are doing. Understand what the media is trying to do. Understand what these schools are trying to do with the children. Understand the direction of the enemies of Islam. They're fighting Islam. You're not fighting a war in some bubble. You are fighting a war that is real. They're fighting Islam. Their cartoons of the Prophet are fighting Islam. Their books of Salman Rushdie, the Mal'oon, is fighting Islam. Their mockery of Muslims is fighting Islam. Their various ways of depicting an ugly image of Islam. Their creation of ISIS is fighting Islam. Their creation of Al-Qaeda is fighting Islam. Them taking their troops to Muslim lands is fighting Islam. These are all things that they're doing. The laws they are putting in place in various European countries is fighting Islam. The British government is putting a law, has already introduced a law that anyone who supports Haj Qasim Soleimani can be sought after by the police. This is fighting Islam. You need to understand that. This is the type of warfare. You understand that context? Then you ask, oh, Holy Quran, oh, Imam Zain al-Abidin, oh, Imam al-Hussein, oh, Imam al-Sadiq, oh, Imam al-Hadi, Imam al-Askari, this is the type of warfare. What should we do in the face of this type of warfare? Look at the riwayat, look at the ahadith, look at the verses of the Quran. The Quran is most available to all of us. Look at what the Quran says. What should I do? When the enemies say, don't mention Haj Qasim Soleimani. If you do, we're going to imprison you. We're going to shut down your masjid. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. What do? You go to the Quran. The Quran says, when the warfare is words, then there's no patience in holding that back. قُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الْكَافِرُونَ لَا أَعْبُدُ مَا تَعْبُدُونَ. Say, the weapon that is available to you is the weapon of words.
They want to silence you because they know your words are effective. You mentioning Haj Qasim Soleimani is causing people to think about who this person is. This person represents the Ahlul Bayt in his actions, in his words. They see him, they realize, oh, this is a Muslim general. Our generals are grumpy. They kill innocent people. They don't know how to be kind to people. They don't go helping countries that don't have money, that don't give them money. They only work for money. For people with big bucks, they won't go help a bunch of orphans and women and children in some village somewhere in this desert without anybody paying for it. And they don't care, kill whatever, just get the job done. Like, oh, your generals are like this? They don't want you to mention Haj Qasim Soleimani. They don't want you to mention Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. They don't want you to mention Imad Mughniya. They don't want you to mention Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. They don't want you to mention Hezbollah. Why? Because it's effective. It's effective. Quran, we ask, oh Quran, what is our responsibility when it comes to these conditions? It's words, it's not the sword. We're not in a contest, they're not fighting us with a sword. The warfare they're using is words against Islam, and then they're telling us to shut up. Do we fight back with words? Do we do the opposite of what they ask us to do? Or do we listen and we shut up? Quran says, قُلْ, say, speak, talk, mention, that no, we will not go with your ways. If you go to the Quran with these real questions, you will start to see Allah will guide you through that Quran, tell you what you need to do. How many times have I been asked, Mawlana, Shaykh, this, that, the other, whatever. What am I supposed to do? Like, look, brother, sister, don't ask me what you need to do. Ask me what are guidelines in Islam about these things. So I'll talk about this is what Islam says in this context. But is this your context? Is it another context? You have to figure out. And then these are general ideas. What do I say about Haj Qasim, for instance? What do I say about Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah? When do I say it? How do I say it? Which are things that you need to figure out. You need to figure out. But that's the quality of a Shia, of the Imam of our time during occultation. Abu Khalid taught us, meaning as a student of the Imams, not independently, obviously, but he gave us an example of a person who was completely disconnected from his Imam, but learned from the Imams. The words of that Imam and the previous Imams, learned from that. Then when the time came for implementation, with that knowledge and understanding the context, he figured it out himself. And he did very well. Very well. You and I can embark on that journey as well. We can start trying to do that. We can want to be like Abu Khalid al-Kabuli was to the fourth Imam, for us to be for the 12th Imam, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. And there is nothing better to ask for, brothers and sisters, in this world. There's nothing better to ask for. The Prophet wished he would be able to spend time with these companions of the 12th Imam. He's on a number of occasions, the Prophet told his companions, he said, I wish I could be with my companions. They said, well, who are your companions? He said, you're good people, but I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about those people. During the occultation, they are, he describes them, who they are. Imam al-Sadiq, when the name of the 12th Imam came, he said, I wish I could serve him. Imam al-Sadiq says, I wish I could serve the 12th Imam. You're here. The 12th Imam is your Imam. You can be that person that serves the Imam and brings the smile to his face. He's happy with you, the way Imam Zain al-Abidin was with Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, from a distance. Abu Khalid didn't see the smile. He struggled. The moment he left this world, then that's when he sees all of that. But he didn't have to see it. The knowledge that was given to him, the ma'rifah, the depth of knowledge he had, the understanding he was able to acquire was such that he knew he was on the right path. He knew what he was doing was what the Imam wants. Based on what? Based on the teachings of the Imam, spending time understanding it, and so on and so forth. It makes it clear this is what we need to do. And I hope that we're able to do it, inshallah. Sallallahu alayki ya Abu Abdullah. Sallallahu alayki ya mazlum. Sallallahu alayki ayyuha ash-shahid bi Karbala atshana. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. My beloved Imam al-Husayn, the Imam who was slaughtered by the shores of the Euphrates, while his mouth was dry of thirst. Ruhi fidaka ya Mawla. There was a time in Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin perhaps had his most difficult moment. He had seen and heard the events in Karbala from the morning. He knew the companions were going to the battlefield one by one. Perhaps he would get news. Now your brother went to the battlefield, Ali ibn al-Akbar. All of those must have been difficult. Imam Zain al-Abidin, a brave, courageous son of Imam al-Husayn, the Imam after him, would like to help and support. Hearing that all these companions are going while he cannot stand is probably very difficult for him. But the most difficult time, I believe, is the time that when his father, Imam al-Husayn, shouted loudly, he may have heard, "Hal min nasirin yansuruni?" Is there anyone to help me? Hal min dhabbin yadhubbu an haram rasulillah? Is there anyone to protect the family of the Prophet? They say Imam Zainul Abidin put all his strength in his arms and legs to be able to force himself up on a sword as a staff, but was not able to stand. The loneliness of Imam al-Husayn. For Imam Zainul Abidin, while he's there, must have been very difficult. Perhaps after that day, every time he remembered his father, the thought that he was there while this was happening was a difficult thought for him. Ala la'natullah ala al-qawm al-zalimeen. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ يَا حُسَيْنَ
يَا حُسَيْنَ يَا حُسَيْنَ يَا حُسَيْنَ يَا حُسَيْنَ يَا حُسَيْنَ يَا حُسَيْنَ يَا حُسَيْنَ Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya
Ya
Hussein.
Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein. Utho Abbas behan waqif bazaar nahi. Utho Abbas behan waqif bazaar nahi. Ek bhatije ke siwa kohi مددگار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار 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 نہیں شام جانا ہے ردا سر پہ نہیں ہے بھیا ہائے عباس اٹھو ہائے عباس اٹھو دل غم زدہ کرے یہ بکا بہن کا نہیں کوئی آسرا اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں گھر سے نکلی تھی تو محمل میں بٹھایا تو نے ہائے عباس اٹھو ہائے عباس اٹھو سفر دوسرا شروع ہے میرا چلی چھوڑ کے بہن کربلا اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں میں نے اس رب کی بھی گلیاں نہ کبھی دیکھی تھی ہائے عباس اٹھو ہائے عباس اٹھو بہن کیا کرے ملیں گے مجھے نئے لوگ اور نئے راستے اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں 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 ماں کی طرح سے میں دربار ستم جاؤں گی ہائے عباس اٹھو ہائے عباس تو بتاؤ ذرا میرے با وفا غریب الوطن کرے کیا بھلا اٹھو بابا بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں سامنے کیسے میں شیری کا کروں گی سوچو ہائے عباس اٹھو ہائے عباس اٹھو کروں میں فغا بندی رسما ہوئی قید سب نبی زادیاں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں اٹھو عباس بہن واقف بازار نہیں یا حسین 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 اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Thank you so much, Brother Khurshid, for your beautiful recitation of that Noha. A stark reminder to us of how of the beautiful relationship shared between Sayyidah Zainab and Hazrat Abbas as well, and how we can see that after the martyrdom of Hazrat Abbas, how Sayyidah Zainab became his embodiment in a certain sense, where she displayed the same strength, the same valor as Hazrat Abbas when she went to the court of Yazid, and she spoke fearlessly to the point where people said that it reminded them of the time of Hazrat Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So thank you, Rashid, for that reminder again of the beautiful and intricate relationships shared between the Ahlul Bayt. Now I would like to begin the question and answer session. And before I start with today's question, I'm going to just start. I'm going to finish with yesterday's last question that was left over. Sheikh, another question says, was the word of the previous imam the biggest evidence of the following imam? If that was the case, then the one who rejected one imam also denied the previous imam. So could you please just explain that a little bit?
I'm not sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm not sure which part of the discussion yesterday this question arises from, and so I'm a little unclear about what is really intended by the question. If the brother or sister can listen to what I'm saying, and then if they find what I'm saying to be irrelevant to their question, they can please correct my understanding by putting a comment there, or I guess rephrasing the question in a way where I can understand it a little better. Each imam was the one who mentioned to at least some of his companions who the next imam is going to be. Before them, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi mentioned all the imams after him, as he was himself an imam. The reason why I say after him, while he was the Rasul, he's also the imam, meaning the task of imamah, the task of leadership, was his task first and foremost. And then the imam succeeded him in imamah, but they did not succeed him in prophethood. They were not anbiya, they were not rasuls, they were not prophets, but they were imams. They succeeded him in the aspect of imam, not in the aspect of prophethood and so on. So in terms of who has given the names of the imams, the Prophet did, each imam did for the next imam. And of course, as in the case of each imam to the followers he had at the time, it wasn't necessarily the case that everybody was informed. Sometimes that was the case, like in the case of Amir al-Mu'mineen, telling the people that after him it's Imam al-Mujtaba. That was a very public announcement, as the conditions dictated for such, or allowed for such a thing to happen. But in the case, for instance, of Imam as-Sadiq, as we mentioned, when he was passing for Imam al-Kadhim, he only mentioned it to a few of the closer companions, like Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, that inshallah we will be discussing at some later time. So if the next imam is rejected, that's rejecting the previous imam. If it's rejection, absolutely. Not only rejection of the previous imam, it's rejecting the Prophet and rejecting Islam. This is what the ahadith mean. If anybody rejects the imamate of the Ahlul Bayt, they are kafir. This is what is meant. It's not a word for us to go to just anybody. Most people don't know. They don't reject. Rejection is after knowing that the imam has said it, the Prophet has said it, I see that he says it, but I reject it. Most people are telling us that, no, we don't think the Prophet has said Ali ibn Abi Talib is his Khalifa. That's what they're saying to us. They're not saying, no, we know the Prophet said it, but we're going to reject it. Okay. If anybody says, whether they say it in words or they don't, but this is actually what their state of mind and heart and thinking is, that they know for a fact that the Prophet appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, they say, I don't want to accept him. Well, that person is rejecting the Prophet before rejecting Ali ibn Abi Talib. Okay, so if any of the imams is rejected by a person that knows the previous imam has told them that the next imam is this person, if with that knowledge and understanding, they say, I don't want to accept, they have rejected the previous imam. By rejecting the previous imam and the following imam, they've rejected the Prophet and they've rejected Islam. Any type of rejecting of any part of Islam that a person knows is from Allah, you say, I don't accept it, that means you're not submitting to Allah. You've rejected the lordship of God. You know he exists, but God says, I want you to accept this person as the imam. You say, I don't want to accept it. Then you're rejecting his lordship. Your tawheed is in question. You don't have the proper tawheed. You say there's only one God, but if you believe there's only one Lord, that means there's only one being that can tell me who to follow and who not to follow. If he says, follow this person, you heard it, but say, no, I don't want to follow that person. That means you don't want to follow God. You don't want to listen. You don't want to obey his lordship. So rejecting an imam after knowing clearly that that is an imam, that's rejecting previous imams, it's rejecting the Prophet, it's rejecting the Quran, it's rejecting Allah's lordship. And that person will be in the pits of hellfire. There's no question about that. But that's for someone who knows. We've had such people. It wasn't only after the demise of the Prophet that some people rejected the imamate of Amir al-Mu'mineen. It was after a number of the imams that things like that happen. Rejecting, I'm talking about rejecting, okay, not lack of knowledge. After the demise of, and the martyrdom actually of Imam al-Kadhim, some of his top representatives in Baghdad, they rejected the imamate of Imam al-Ridha. They said he's a liar. They said Imam al-Kadhim has not died. He's gone into occultation where they knew every bit of it is a lie. For what? They had some khums money that had been left with them. Some thousands of gold coins, 10,000 gold coins for one of them. There's a few of them, of some of these representatives of the seventh imam. He was in prison for the last few years, and they had that khums money left with them. When the imam was martyred, they decided to claim, so that the Shias don't come and take the money back from them, they started claiming, oh, the imam has actually gone into occultation. He didn't even die. Imam al-Ridha is lying. He's not the imam. We have had these forms of rejection of the imams by people who believed and followed previous imams. When they did that, they not only rejected Imam al-Ridha, they rejected Imam al-Kadhim, they rejected the Prophet, they rejected Quran and Islam. They left all of them. They will be in the pits of hellfire unless any of them did tawbah, which there's no evidence that we're aware of that they repented afterwards. They kept their view. They kept saying Imam al-Ridha is a liar until the end of their life. La'anatullah alayhim. And whoever does this, that knows the truth, but rejects it.
Oh yeah, so Sheikh, the question, the sister asked a question, clarified, and she says it was related to Muhammad bin Hanafiya, and she says, like, basically, does it imply that they didn't understand the imamate of previous imams going right up to the imamate of Imam Ali alayhi salam if they don't recognize the imam of their time? So that's what she intended to ask.
Now, when it gets a little more specific, it's a little more difficult for me to explain that regarding that particular individual. The facts that we have about him are the following. He was raised by Amir al-Mu'mineen. If he's raised by Amir al-Mu'mineen, he knows imamate. That's very clear. And during the time of Imam al-Mujtaba, he doesn't seem, we don't have evidence of him separating from the path of Imam al-Mujtaba during his time. For instance, the difficult test that came about when the Imam accepted the treaty, a lot of the followers of the Imams did not understand what that was about. They thought that Al-Ayyadu Billah, God forbid, Imam al-Mujtaba is a coward. And he doesn't want to fight. Al-Ayyadu Billah, which it was his bravery that led him to accept that treaty, knowing what's coming, the aftermath of it, and so on and so forth. For Islam, he did it. Anyhow, so he's not one of the voices that was heard rejecting Imam al-Mujtaba or calling him names, Al-Ayyadu Billah, like some of the others did. He's not found there in that context, rejecting the imamate of Imam al-Mujtaba. During Imam al-Husayn's imamah, the 10 years before Karbala, there's no evidence of him rejecting it. But the very fact that at that point of Karbala beginning, him rejecting imamah in the form of not following the orders. Okay. That shows he is separating from the path of Imam al-Husayn. Then afterwards, well, he knew how Imam, the Imam has to tell the next Imam or tell people who the next Imam is. Claiming Imam is not something that you have a right to do. You can't just come up and decide that, oh, I'm the next Imam. That's not how it works. And he knew that. He knew how Amir al-Mu'mineen told the people, Imam al-Mujtaba. Imam al-Mujtaba didn't just come out and say, I'm the next Imam on his own. He knows that. So then coming and claiming Imam and not following, and then afterwards when Imam Zain al-Abidin tells him that again, it's unfortunately that's rejecting Imam as much as he probably told people that they need to follow Amir al-Mu'mineen, they need to follow Imam al-Mujtaba, and perhaps Imam al-Husayn. That's not very clear. We don't have too much evidence of what all he said, but the Kaysaniyya were known to believe in three of our Imams, and then afterwards Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya. So that means that supposedly they consider Imam al-Husayn the Imam, but I don't know how they justify Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya not following. Perhaps some of the justifications we hear amongst the Ithna Asharis has actually come from the Kaysaniyya. Because some of the Ithna Asharis, they justify, they say, no, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya, Imam told him to stay. No, there's no evidence of the Imam telling. That's justifying his wrongdoing. Justifying the rebellion against the Imam that manifested, but then got a lot worse. So although he told probably his followers to consider those three Imams prior to him as Imams, but when you reject the fourth Imam, that's correct what was mentioned in the question. You're actually rejecting the previous Imams, and you're rejecting the Prophet, and you're rejecting Islam for a person who knows, and Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya knew what he was doing. So yeah, that's, I guess, completing that, those comments in regards to...
Okay. I hope that goes some way to answering the question. It was a very in-depth answer as well. Now we shall begin with the questions that were related to today's lecture more so. So the first question I have here goes to say, considering that during battles and uprisings in the times of Imam Ali, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and even later, a lot of people who supported the Imams saw them as suitable leaders while not fully believing in the institution of Imamate. So when inshallah Imam Mahdi ajallallahu ta'ala farajah will come, will people who are non-Shia but consider him to be the rightful leader be allowed to join his army? And they're asking, since there are non-Shia faiths that also have a belief in the coming of Imam Mahdi or a Messiah.
Absolutely. Not only Muslims that don't identify as Shia, there will be masses of people that will support Imam al-Hujjah that don't even identify as Muslim or even any religion. You'll have people who are agnostic, people who say we don't believe in any organized religion because of whatever misinformation they have about religion as a whole. You will have them coming and joining. And of course, when they come and join, they won't remain as such, but when they initially support the Imam, they're supporting him without fully understanding why he's such a great person, why they need to support him, but they see him compared to all the other leaders that are around, they see him to be a suitable leader. And so they want to follow him. Eventually, that decision of theirs will lead them to see the truth of Islam, see the truth of the institution of Imamah, the Quran, and all the other things that come along with it. But in the initial stage of joining it, they are not going to be where they will become or they will get to later on. And it was like that during the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin as well. All these followers that we say, all these people that the Imams wanted Abu Khalid to bring and Abu Khalid brought, it's not like all of them started praying the way we know is the correct way of praying. Or all of them started to believe in the institution of Imamah and that who all the previous Imams are as Imams, and all of them believe. They didn't, it's not clear and that all of them had that view, and it's actually clear that most of them didn't have that view. Yet, they understood that they need to support the Ahlul Bayt for governance. And they were willing to sacrifice for it. That's the extent of their understanding, and they came for it. And that's an army for the Imam. Okay. And this helps us understand that our responsibility in drawing masses towards the Imam of our time is not limited to the Shia. It's not limited to the Muslimin. We have got to understand. In fact, we can learn from the example of Abu Khalid by studying that part of history, to see amongst the average and amongst the masses that didn't know all the details that Abu Khalid knew, someone like Abu Khalid, with all the details he knows, how was he able to attract so many people? And he didn't consider it his taklif and his responsibility to go and make sure that every single one of them says, Ashhadu anna aliyya waliyullah. But he created an army. I mean, that's an art. And that requires a lot of understanding. Sometimes we think that, oh, the only way to create an army for the Imam is to get people who are currently Muslim or bring people to Islam. They have to say, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, Ashhadu anna Muhammad Rasulullah, Ashhadu anna aliyya waliyullah. Otherwise, no, that's not how it works. In fact, we have hadith about this, that those, a couple of hadith, when you put them together, the conclusion is this. Some of those that thought he is from them will reject him. Who thinks that the Imam is from them? The Shia. And Abadatu Shams, another hadith says, those who worship the sun, not even Christians or Jews, Abadatu Shams, those who worship these different deities, they will join the 12th Imam. We have hadith on this. We know this. So when we're thinking about drawing people towards the Imam of our time, we have to correct that part of our understanding that makes us think it must be amongst these current Shias. No, that's not the case. That doesn't mean that we don't work on and amongst the Shia. No, the top generals of the Imam are currently Shia. But those who identify as Shia are not necessarily in the Imam's army either. Some of those who identify as Shia, it's how they identify. The Imam doesn't identify him as Shia. Like, you're not following me. You're following whatever you want. You're not following me. You're not our Shia. But from those who know this ideology and who are following it on very closely, on a very high level, and those are the top generals, and we do need to do work amongst the Shia for ourselves, first and foremost, to become some of those top generals, but also if we then have the ability to have that impact and effect on some of the youth in the Shia community, then alhamdulillah. But our work is not limited to that. We can create an army of people from amongst various peoples of the various countries, various nations, that when the Imam comes, they will be on his side. Referencing back to the point we were mentioning, because I feel that perhaps for some of us that's not a thought process that we're involved in, but we do need to, that needs to become our thought process. How do we do that? What exactly does that mean? What type of people, how can we draw a person to the Imam of our time without telling them of the Imam of our time? If we tell them about the Imam of our time, then they accept him, then they're Shia. We're talking about those who aren't, and they won't be when the Imam comes, yet we've helped them become the soldiers and the army of the Imam of our time. What does that exactly mean? What do we need to encourage in people? That the people who are further out, who are not ready to accept Islam, who are not ready to accept tashayyu, it's too far for them. They need to take steps. But there is something else, perhaps. There is. We need to figure out what it is. That if we help them want that and move in that direction, that they will become members of the army of the Imam. And when he comes and when he starts his movement, that those people will be some of the first to go. They will be first in line before those who identify currently as Shia. There are things that we can do in that regard. And I hope that, inshallah, we think about that.
Okay, that's excellent, Sheikh. Next question also pertains to asking about Imam al-Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala faraja. It says, in our general observation, not a lot of scholars speak about Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, although he is the most important personality for us, being the Imam of our time. Isn't there a lot of information available in the history about Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam? And if so, why do we keep hearing this? I suppose they're trying to say, why do we keep hearing repetitive information?
I will take that for myself as a reminder. In other words, I will take that as a criticism of us. I will include myself in those who are speaking of the Imam. For example, or first and foremost, it is unfortunate that we speak less of the Imam. It's very unfortunate. The Hadith says, remember him and await his coming day in and day out. That means our thought process, which should reflect in our talks and our conversations, should be that it's always on our mind. If it's always on our mind, we're going to be talking about it. So that's very unfortunate. I hope that Allah forgives us for not mentioning him as frequently. That is very accurate, that the Imam of our time is the most important figure right now. If we know all the itty-bitty details of the lives of all the ma'sumin, but we don't know enough about our Imam, and we're not mindful of his current obligations and our current obligations towards him, it means nothing. We haven't done anything. It's the same criticism that we have of people who talk about the Prophet but didn't follow Amir al-Mu'mini. It doesn't matter if you say you believe in that name. If you're not following him, then you're not following him. If you're not caring about what he's doing and what he's caring about and what he's trying to accomplish and what your responsibilities towards him are, then it doesn't matter if you call his name. And so that's very accurate, and it's very true, and we need to have that. And lastly, there is an abundance of information. It needs tapping into. It needs studying. There is so much to know, and our knowledge, acquaintance with the 12th Imam for us is this imaginary figure that we know a name, and we think he's, even the idea of his occultation is not clear to us. We think that he disappeared. Like he didn't disappear. He never disappeared. He's always been right here on earth. In no other realm, no hidden realm, right here on earth. We don't even know that much. And that causes us not to be able to relate to, because we don't have information. We don't know him. But there's an abundance of information. And I ask God to forgive us for not talking about it. And I hope that we do have, we need to have series of lectures for 15th of Sha'ban. Series. At least 5 nights, 10 nights. Talk just about the 12th Imam. That's the time. Because the 12th Imam doesn't have a Shahada, we don't do 10 nights or 15 nights or 5 nights or whatever. That's unfortunate. He's our living Imam. Well, he has a birthday, 15th of Sha'ban. Let's do 5 nights, 10 nights. On the occasion of the 15th of Sha'ban. Not just one night and then all of that qasidas, manqabat, and all of that. It's great. Have qasida, manqabat, just like we have Nuhan and Salam or Suz or whatever before and after. But there needs to be understanding too. Have someone that can gather that information, present. These are the words. We have so many words of the 12th Imam. Entire books have been written about the words of the 12th Imam and things related to the 12th Imam. During the early days of the major occultation, there were at least 3 major books written by the reputable scholars of the time, 3 major works. There's other pieces, articles, and so on, but 3 major works. 2 of them are called Al-Ghaiba. One of them belongs to Al-Nu'mani, the other one belongs to Sheikh Al-Tusi. And then there's a 3rd book, Kamaluddin wa Tamamun Ni'mah, 2 volumes by Sheikh Al-Saduq. Earlier than Sheikh Al-Tusi, and perhaps earlier than Al-Nu'mani. I'm not too sure of the timeline of Nu'mani. I think he was earlier. But Sheikh Al-Saduq is between Al-Nu'mani and Sheikh Al-Tusi. 3 major works were written entirely about the 12th Imam and his occultation. 2 of them have the title of Ghaiba there, there's a lot of information. There's historic, there's so much. We barely maybe hear the miraculous birth of the 12th month. We don't even hear the extent of that. Basic information. And then more than basic information, analysis, analyzing the period of the minor occultation, the Nawab of the 12th Imam. It's very important for us to understand that period. I hope that we have opportunities where we can do that, if not 15th of Sha'ban and stuff, at least during these times when we do 5 nights and 10 nights and people are more open to having that many lectures and so on. I hope that we decide as communities to talk about those subjects, inshallah.
Inshallah. Sheikh, the next question is more so aimed towards the upbringing of children. It says, if we want our children to develop a ma'rifat of Ahlul Bayt, how critical is it for us to create a social circle for them where they can socialize with youth from mu'mineen families? And how damaging can it be for them to socialize with the youth whose value systems conflict with ours?
I'll start from the last bit. Allowing them to socialize with those who have, the wrong ideology and so on and so forth. Why would a good person even want to socialize with such people? A child is raised in a house and then the doors open and they leave the house and they start socializing with different people. If a youth is fine with and enjoys and likes socializing on a level that affects them. I'm in no way suggesting that we cannot have chit-chat with even non-Muslims. We cannot have conversations and spend time. No, that's a different thing. In a way that it influences us. Why would I want to be influenced? Have a type of relationship with someone that is not good, and I want to socialize with them in a way where I see it's affecting me. Why would a youth want to do that? Why would a good Muslim youth want to do that? If we don't provide proper channels for a person to socialize, the need for having company and companionship with people, with other individuals, not in the context of marriage only, when I said the word companionship, a lot of times that's used in the context of marriage. Having somebody that you spend time with, you enjoy their company. You like talking to them. They talk to you, you talk back, you go back, you share certain things. Just the purpose of it isn't this conversation or that conversation. It's about having that acquaintance and feeling good when you're with them and you enjoy their company. That's basically it. There's a need for that. If that is not fulfilled, then obviously the way it's going to be fulfilled is in a different way. If the good people that we know are good and they're better in terms of their akhlaq towards that child behave in a way where that child or that youth, when they grow up, they enter that their teens, they don't feel like being around them, have bad akhlaq, well, they don't enjoy their company. Then they're going to go and find someone that doesn't have that bad akhlaq, which is a lesser problem, but they have bad other things, bad beliefs, bad ideology, bad behavior in other ways. But in terms of their relationship with this person, they're pleasant. So understanding that tells us a couple of things. Now we get to the first part of that. Creating or having, you can't force a person, be it youth or otherwise, but especially youth, by a parent. In all cases it's like this, but especially youth by a parent. You can't force companionship with someone that you identify as good. That's not something that's doable. You can want it as much as you want. You can create the environment for it by taking them over their house or I don't know, whatever. If that child does not find it pleasant or find it enjoyable to spend time with them, it's not going to work. And they need another outlet. So they're going to go find someone else. It's not going to work. What I would suggest and recommend is, as parents, first and foremost, then the other things will follow this step. If this is done right, everything else will follow. You be your child's first friend. You behave with them in a way, treat them in a way, as a human being, not as an inferior, as this thing that doesn't understand that you just slap them. Or I'm not saying anybody's doing that, but I'm just putting out ideas of what some of the wrong things that we hear sometimes parents being involved in. If since childhood this child has not seen too much of a pleasant person, or as a child it was nice, they bought me candy, all of that stuff, but they never took me serious as a person, to listen to me, to hear me, to enjoy my company. As a parent, enjoy your child's company the way they are, not the way you expect a 40-year-old to be, not the way you expect a 30-year-old to be. Enjoy their company as a 10-year-old, as a 9-year-old. When they talk, listen to them, hear them. Don't think they're stupid or dumb. They're making a comment. Think about it. Where did that come from? And try to communicate and join a conversation, engage in conversation with them. Let them start enjoying the company of their parents. If a child enjoys the company of their parents, then that need is fulfilled. They're not dying to engage with just anybody. They already have it. Then they can be selective. When they're going out of the house, they see, well, this person is pleasant in these ways, but no, my parents are better. Or there's this other thing that they're doing. Well, I don't want to be around this person. They don't remember God. They don't remember the Ahlul Bayt. I don't want to be around them. If I'm dying, a person who's dying in the desert, you give them some rotten piece of meat, they'll take it and eat it because they need to eat. Give a person who's dying of thirst, give them the filthiest water, they'll drink it. Why? Because they're dying. They're in need. A person who doesn't have proper companionship, they don't have people that they enjoy their company, then yeah, some ugly dude with some ugly behavior, but then at least they smile, they laugh at their jokes. They do something that this person likes besides all the wrong that they... I'm like, okay, it's something at least. It's better than nothing. I don't get anything. I'm not appreciated in any way. If parents, first and foremost, as parents, because the question was about that, not the community, not other... Parents, first and foremost, try to... We have hadith on this. This is all the explanation of a hadith that says... For parents, that they need to be like children with their children. Okay, don't be like an adult with your child. Be like a child. When they reach the teenage years, be like a teenager for them, not an adult that wants to be with adults. Understand that you need to enjoy their company as they are, and then you'll be surprised. Once you allow that, you'll be surprised that they're so mature. You'll start seeing a lot more maturity in them. And then you really start, first maybe you fake it a little bit, but eventually you start really enjoying their company. You really start seeing, oh my God, this was really mature, this thing, really thought about this. This is really good. And you'll start seeing that, oh, I didn't realize how much I could enjoy the company of my own kids at home. And I was doing all this other stuff and I was miserable. Now you see that it's not only having to get them to do homework and do this and do that. Why aren't they doing this? And realize that, well, you need to get on to them sometimes for not doing certain things or to make sure they do certain things. But a lot of other times, you're enjoying it together and enjoying each other's company. Once we do that, then we can go towards, in terms of friends, guiding the child. This is the last thing I will say. And again, apologies for the length, but I felt it was needed for that question. Don't choose friends and associates for your children. Help them choose the right ones by giving them time, letting them try a relationship with a person, but also letting them be open to you. not behaving with them in a way where they want to shut you out and do things without you knowing. And although they will still do that to a degree, that's fine. That's understanding that this person is going through experiences and learning in life. That's fine. When you find out that they did something that you weren't aware of, don't blow up on them every single time or blow up on them at all. Even if you need to get on them, do it wisely and tell them why it's not good, and tell them that, you know, if you would have told me, for instance, that, you know, okay, I would have, we could have talked about it. So help them choose the right circle of friends. But as a parent, yes, it is important to know that the wrong circle of friends is very bad. So you do need to help your child have the right circle of friends. The explanations that I previously gave were explaining how from childhood going into teenage years and adulthood, adolescence and adulthood, how you can help your child develop that type of relationship and avoid developing a relationship with people that they shouldn't have those relationships with.
That's perfect. And as usual, very intricate, very in-depth, and very insightful as well. Thank you, Sheikh, for that particular answer and the lecture, which provides us with a lot of insight, actually, and like with a lot of knowledge that we're missing out on before. I'd also like to thank Brother Ali Mirza, Brother Ali Mujtaba, and Brother Khurshid Abbas as well for their contributions as well, recitation of the Holy Quran, the Salam, and the Noha as well. And thank you, Sheikh, and hope to join you again tomorrow between the same times of 6 to 7:30 p.m. Dublin time. We have a few questions remaining from today, which we shall answer tomorrow, inshallah. And any more questions that may arise, I do urge that you write them down, and inshallah, we can get to them tomorrow. In the meantime, take care of yourself. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.